Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the election results coming in, with many polls closing in the East as we go to air, and speak with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. We'll assess the extent of a probable but narrow presidential victory for Hillary Clinton and whether that will extend to the close Senate races, which will be critical in determining whether or not a new Clinton administration will be able to overcome gridlock and govern at all, since Republicans in Congress have blocked Obama at every turn and have already threatened to deny Clinton any appointments to the Supreme Court. With a dysfunctional judicial branch and a paralyzed legislative branch, the possible victories for Democratic U.S. Senate candidates in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Missouri, with a tie in North Carolina, appear to augur well for what could be a Hillary Clinton presidency. Then we'll examine the results in Ohio, a must-win state for Donald Trump, and speak with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. He's the author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, and we will discuss whether in this election the Electoral College is likely to come into play in what is called a misfire, when the winner of the popular vote is not the winner in the Electoral College, which is what happened in Florida in 2000. And then we'll get an update from Nicole Hemmer, a professor in presidential studies at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report, and the author of Messengers of the Right. She joins us to discuss whether or not the much-promised undercover voters for Trump materialized, and if, after a Trump loss, they will accept defeat and either form a new party or fester in further alienation. Then finally, we will look into results in Florida, which is another must-win state for Donald Trump, and speak with Amy Hollifield, the government and politics editor of the St. Petersburg Times, who oversees PolitiFact.com, the Times' fact-checking website, which received the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. She joins us to discuss the latest results in the close presidential race, as well as the key Senate race, which had Marco Rubio ahead of his Democratic challenger, Patrick Murphy, in a race that is close, but might have been closer had the Democrats not conducted political triage, pulling their money away from their candidate, then later deciding to fund him. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be with you again, as always.
Well, thank you, Richard. And at this point, it's difficult to know or to predict with any certainty who's the winner here. But it certainly seems to be, and with some access to some exit polling, it does seem to be that Hillary Clinton's going to eke out a narrow victory. And I guess the most promising thing here is that the Democratic U.S. Senate candidates in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Missouri, and even North Carolina are looking hopeful. So if she is to win, then we're not going to have a repeat of the kind of gridlock that we've seen in the Obama administration.
One hopes. This is the great question. I think you're right. I think she does win. And I think there's going to be a significant pickup of seats in the Senate. And I think we might have even gotten a couple more had James Comey not cast the electoral votes of the Federal Bureau of Investigation against her. And we're going to have to just live with that. You know, this is a situation in which an enormous amount of insider skill is going to be required. And she has a great deal of that. She knows Washington. She knows the Senate. She has personal relationship with many of the senators now seated, and we're just going to have to see. And I think that the big question for me is what happens to Donald Trump. I don't think that he's going to go away. I think that he's going to treat this as if it were just one more Atlantic City bankruptcy and go on. The money that he can make from being a perennial candidate for the next few years is staggering. Look at the amounts of money that people like Sarah Palin have made by running in that way, not actually seeking office again, but just playing to that audience and their interests. I think also that this idea that he might start a TV network has got to be giving conniptions to Rupert Murdoch. But on the other hand, I think it could also be an important way for him to hold on to visibility. What his strategy is going to be is what interests me. I think that he's going to line up with the Freedom Caucus and try to trounce Ryan and others who might have been able to work with Hillary. I think that's the most concerning thing, but we'll see.
Well, I suppose if our audience thought that the movement conservatives on the Tea Party, the Republican right, treated, and Donald Trump in particular, treated Barack Obama with disrespect, surely a Bannon, Ailes, Trump, 24/7 hate speech TV internet network that'll be the alt-right version of Fox News, mm-hmm. it's going to be off the charts, isn't it?
Well, I think so. And I mean, I think this is another one of those traumatic moments in American history that we cannot discount. That the legacy of the 1960s is playing itself out 50 years later. There hasn't been a resolution of the economic crisis that has afflicted the country in terms of income distribution since the Reagan era. And for the time being, there are substantial, staggering, in fact, numbers of voters who want to blame Democrats for essentially a set of policies that were policies that derived directly from Ronald Reagan.
Well, the Republicans, even though they've been in power for some time in the legislative branch, still have an oppositional mentality that goes back to their many decades in the wilderness. And they seem to, it's extraordinary that they don't have any programs. They're against everything, but not for anything except tax cuts for the rich. And yet somehow they've been able to tap in to the discontent largely caused by the 2008 crash, which happened under a Republican, George W. Bush. So it's an amazing situation that the Republicans could create dysfunction and gridlock and yet profit from it.
Right. Well, again, I mean, the legacy of the Clinton administration and the caution of the Obama administration at critical early moments when they were both taking over the reins of power have contributed to this situation. There was plenty of public support for going after bankers individually, not just banks, in the wake of the 2008 crash. And if you believe Ron Suskind's book, Obama actually was willing to take on Citibank and put it into basically receivership. And then his own financial advisors within the administration essentially ignored him. And I think that we have to consider what the weakness of the Democratic Party is that has allowed this kind of Republican Party to emerge.
And, of course, when Bill Clinton got elected, he in 92, he had both the House, the Senate, and the White House. The Democrats had all three branches, and mm-hmm. very little happened. And 2 years later, Newt Gingrich came along.
Well, I mean, I think a lot happened. I'm an economist, and I think what he did was move away from essentially the Keynesian message that had carried the Democratic coalitions since the 1930s. And he was persuaded to do that by Bob Rubin and others. He said rather than spend money and create jobs and start large infrastructure projects in 1993, what you need to do is close the deficit, because the deficit will then bring interest rates down, which will then raise the bond market's value, which in turn will free the banks to begin lending again. And in fact, it worked out that way. And incomes did increase in the second administration of Bill Clinton for most people, not just the top 1%. But it was because they were riding a capital bubble, a tech stock bubble, that meant that they couldn't sustain it. And, of course, it crashed as Clinton was leaving office, but was blamed on George Bush. And then Bush, in a kind of cynical version of Keynesianism, wrapped himself in the mantle of Ronald Reagan, declared that we needed big supply-side tax cuts, which meant tax cuts on the rich and tax cuts on capital, went ahead and pushed that through the Congress, and then proceeded to run gargantuan deficits, just as Reagan and his father had done, continuing this process of further and further indebting the United States in order to transfer wealth to a really small percentage of the American population.
But that's the amazing mechanism. When I mentioned the 92 to 94 interregnum, the idea that the Democrats get all three branches, and then 2 years later they lose it, and the same thing happened with Obama. And the, right. And it's amazing to think that you have a situation where you have huge deficits. At the same time, you have massive, massive capital surpluses in corporate America sitting mm-hmm. offshore. And a great deal, great need for infrastructure spending. And with interest rates at all-time lows, it's a no-brainer. So right. what explains this paralysis in untapped wealth at the same time, increasing deficits, which, of course, the Republicans say the sky is falling, but essentially it's been a tactic.
What explains it? Let me see. I mean, what explains it is a decade of disillusionment with government that began under Lyndon Johnson and continued on under Richard Nixon. And when you look at trust in government data, like my colleague Bob Putnam has done, you see that as late as 1965, 75% of the American people trusted government to do the right thing all or most of the time. A decade later, a year after Nixon was out of office, that number had plummeted from 75 to 25. And the reaction of the Democrats was on some level understandable, which was in the wake of the enormous defeat George McGovern had experienced in 1972, party leaders, party elders turned toward the business-oriented kind of Democratic Party, the kind that had dominated the Democratic Party in the 1920s when people like James Cox were being nominated for the presidency. And we forget that that wing of the party has always been there, and it's been quietly powerful, but the strength of the, I don't want to call it populist, I guess I should call it liberal, because that's what it was. It was a kind of old-fashioned liberalism that cared deeply about the direction of income distribution measures. And, you know, the period from 1945 to 1975 was a period of ever-growing equality of income and wealth in the United States. And then it began to reverse. And as it reversed, the Democratic Party gave way on being democratic. You know, I'm the biography of John Kenneth Galbraith, and there's a moment that Galbraith met with Bill Clinton about a year and a half after Clinton left office. And what I remember about that conversation, because I was there along with Mrs. Galbraith, was the following. Galbraith by then was in his 90s, and Clinton had come to him proposing that the two of them write a book together about American government, which was fascinating in and of itself. Galbraith declined, but they had an hour-long conversation at the Galbraith home here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What I always remember was that the last moment, as Clinton got up to leave, Galbraith reached over, 6'8", and with this massive claw of a hand, grabbed hold of President's shoulder and said, "Mr. President, I just want to say one thing, and I said it to Harry Truman. What this country doesn't need is two Republican parties." And what we've had in some ways since the McGovern defeat is two Republican parties, or Republican dark and Republican light.
So, Richard Parker, back to the race, and at this point, it's difficult to be definitive about any of the results. That obviously,
The easy states are whether rolling in right
exactly.
now. Exactly, the difficult states have not yet begun to roll in.
The easy states are coming in exactly. Although it does look like Hillary Clinton's doing well in Florida.
Yes, right.
And that, of course, without Florida, Donald Trump's in big trouble.
Right, exactly.
But
I think that if Florida is declared for Hillary by 9 o'clock, there is a 80 to 85% chance that she's going to take this in a walk.
Meaning what, though, in terms of...
that if she denies Trump Florida, I just don't see what the pathway is.
Right.
I don't see what the pathway to the White House is.
Right, but there's a difference between a victory and a walk. I mean, you don't see a sweep here, do you? Because Trump's definitely looks like he's got Ohio, and as we mentioned, he's picked up West Virginia, Indiana, Kentucky.
Right. Those are all the easies. We knew that. Not one of those was a contestable state.
Right.
That's about as contestable as California is for Hillary.
Right, right. So I guess so far, again, you know, one has to be sort of cautious here. The good news for the Democrats seems to be with the U.S. Senate. And, of course, that extends to Hillary Clinton, because without the Senate, she, all of her problems with the Republicans over the Supreme Court go away. And also, she actually has the ability to govern, even though the Republicans will be extremely obstructionist in the House. What do you expect to happen, though, if there is a Trump loss, which that appears to be the case, with the movement conservatives, the Tea Party people, and these so-called undercover voters that apparently aren't going to show up in sufficient numbers to put?
So I think a couple of things. I think that Trump would be, I would be surprised if he walked away from presidential politics just because he'd been defeated. If he loses, this is like losing one casino in Atlantic City. He's still got more game left in him. And right now, the Freedom Caucus inside the Republican Party is breathing down the necks of the leadership, which is by no means progressive, but the ultra-right is breathing down the necks of the right. And if he stakes out a position as the perennial presidential nominee or candidate-in-waiting or president-in-waiting of that far-right wing, I think that he can play havoc with the conservative leadership of the party, and I think he will be inclined to do so.
Well, you mentioned Richard Parker, the influence or the impact of FBI Director Comey's letter and the subsequent retraction. Which my understanding is that Trump, that this man has such a massive ego about his own self-righteousness and being above politics, that his own reputation is more important to him than his duty. And he has really impacted American democracy in the most arrogant way, and apparently doesn't even seems to recognize what he's done. But there's also...
I'd add a further thing, which is, there are incredibly lucrative opportunities if he keeps himself in the public eye, which diminish very quickly if he chooses to step back. This idea of a television network or a cable network for him is one example. Endorsements of all kinds, speaking fees. If it is true that a lot of his money now comes from branding and not from real estate, this is a tremendous opportunity to add millions and millions and millions of dollars to his net worth. And I think that he is absolutely so oriented toward that constant aggregation of wealth that alone is reason enough to stay active in the Republican Party if defeated, and to go to war essentially with the Republican congressional leadership in an attempt to define the candidates that will run next cycle. Because as you understand, in 2018, it's a much tougher map for the Democrats. This was a year when the Republicans had to face real tough calls, and a lot more seats were at risk. Next time, it's just the reverse. And, Kellyanne Conway and the other advisors know this. And why wouldn't he stay in the race in order to claim victory if they could pick up 10, 20, 30, 40 seats in the midterm? Because then the midterm becomes a proxy for 2020. And if it's a strong sweep and she looks even weaker because she has an even smaller congressional delegation, I mean, my goodness, he's got a story to tell.
Right. But the reason I brought up Comey, just in closing, Richard Parker, is that just like the Watergate inquiry happened after the presidential election, And much of the investigations into Trump's relations with the Russians are underway. There are reports that there have there's been a FISA warrant issued. It's possible and that this Trump server in the Trump Tower is connected to the Alpha Bank, and directly there's a back channel between Trump and the Russians. If indeed all of this information comes out, you may have a serious situation, because there's no question that the Russians have been interfering in our election.
Right. No, and I think that it's and a perverse reversal of what the Republicans did to Democrats under Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. This could be who has become a secret agent of Russian power, not Soviet power, but Russian power. So we'll see. And, you know, of course, what you're outlining is a strategy for debilitating him if he does stay in politics. But I can't see him stepping back, and I see him finessing the whole question of the Putin relationship. So we'll see.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, as always. We'll keep watching for the outcome.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former manager editor of Ramparts, the co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Amy Hollifield of the St. Petersburg Times to talk about what's happening now in this very key state of Florida. What have we done? How did we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. All of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Get used to the dust.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Amy Hollifield, who is the government and politics editor of the St. Petersburg Times. She oversees state and national political coverage, including the paper's bureaus in Tallahassee and Washington, and at politifact.com, the Times' fact-checking website, which received the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. She has more than a decade of experience working in newspapers in Florida, including at the Miami Herald and Florida Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Hollifield.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, Amy. And I know we want to talk later, but this is a movable feast here tonight as results come in. Many of our guests are doing TV shots all the time. So thank you for joining us. And is there anything to report? I know the polls closed at different times in the state of Florida, but where are we now in terms of a percentage of the vote counted?
We've got 8.5 million ballots counted, and Donald Trump has a slight lead over Hillary Clinton so far. There are almost 13 million voters in Florida, so I would say we still got a ways to go. I'm not sure he'll hold on to that lead, because we're seeing huge numbers in South Florida where there's a ton of Democrats. And even right now where I am in the Tampa Bay area, through Tampa Bay and Orlando, it's really the swing regions of the state. And in our two local counties, Hillary Clinton has got the lead. So if any of those numbers catch up, I think you'll see it tighten up.
So give us a sense then of where this will lead. If you've got those trends, and I believe around Orlando, there is a substantial Latino vote, which is largely Puerto Rican, is it not? So, and that's how much is that offset by the more conservative Cuban vote down in Miami?
Yeah, it's actually offset by the northern part of the state. Florida is really three regions: the northern part of the state, which is really conservative, the southern part of the state, which is very liberal and Democratic leaning, and then the middle part of the state, which is pretty much a toss-up and can go either way. But what I like is the turnout that we've seen, which has been really huge for in the Hispanic community. They've had a 100% increase in Hispanics voting in 2016 than voted in 2012. And that is going to make a difference. But this state has been running neck and neck for the whole time. So I think it's going to be close no matter what it is.
And what is the sense then of how, if I take it that Donald Trump more or less has to win Florida, does he not? And it looks like he will win Ohio, but Hillary Clinton could lose it and still win, but he... If he doesn't win Florida, he pretty much loses. Is that the calculus?
That's absolutely the calculus. And I'll tell you, I've been through many elections in Florida, and we don't always get a result really promptly. In 2012, we didn't know who won Florida until Saturday after the election. I'm really hoping it'll be tonight because it'll be decisive as far as who wins the presidency.
And in terms of the Senate race, where does that stand, given that there's an indication that with the presidential race still being very tight, the Democrats look like they're doing well, the Senate candidates in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Missouri, even a tie in North Carolina, and Tammy Duckworth picked up Illinois. I believe Marco Rubio has been declared the winner, has he not, in Florida?
Exactly. Minutes after the polls closed in the Panhandle at 8 o'clock, Marco Rubio was declared the winner and earned re-election to the Senate, which is really not terribly surprising. He's been leading in those polls almost since he got back into the Senate race in June. Patrick Murphy, his opponent, is a young congressman. Who didn't really have the experience to compete with Rubio.
Well, what happened there with the Democrats, though? They pulled their funding from Patrick Murphy, and then they did sort of political triage. They pulled their funding, but then they decided to refund him, and that was not exactly a vote of confidence, was it?
No, I mean they could see the polls going against him. We had a couple debates in that race where Murphy did pretty okay, but here's Marco Rubio who did 17-19 debates against the Republican presidential field. He's pretty battle tested. I think national Democrats decided, look, we're not going to win this one. Let's put our money elsewhere and where we have a better chance of knocking somebody off. And it just got a little tighter with a few polls that I think they came in and tried. There were so many visits from Hillary Clinton and all of her surrogates, and Patrick Murphy sort of tried to ride that wave and appear with Obama and appear with Joe Biden whenever they were here and tried to, I think they thought maybe, just maybe, he could get a boost off of Hillary Clinton, but that did not work.
And what about the other Democrat that challenged Murphy? Would he have done it better, Alan Grayson?
It's hard to imagine he would have done better.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that recently, like what a race that would have been, Alan Grayson against Marco Rubio. But I just think Marco Rubio had the experience. He has, he's already been elected statewide as a senator. And even though he sort of made it clear he didn't like being a senator and also made it clear that he was ready to be a private citizen, I think people were ready to have an experienced politician that they could elect.
But on the other hand, he says he's not going to run for president again. I don't believe him. Do you?
I do not believe him. And I think most people don't believe him. But I think Florida would also really like a president in the White House. And if Marco Rubio is the way to get it, I think a lot of people will support that.
So what other races are you following, Amy Holifield, apart from...
We've got a couple of amendments where we've got an amendment about medical marijuana to make that legal in Florida. We've had that on the ballot before and it hasn't passed.
Uh-huh.
I think there's it hasn't been called yet, but it's running about 70% of the vote. And we need 60% of the vote to put it in our constitution and allow it to be legal in Florida. So I think that will happen and that'll be a big thing for our state.
And how much is Donald Trump considers, Florida, his second home, does he not? Do Floridians see him as one of their own?
Yeah, I mean, he's been around. He's part of the community. I think it's more of a South Florida thing than farther up than that. You know, he's certainly a well-known celebrity, and that's not unknown. But he in the presidential primary in March, when he faced Marco Rubio, he just decimated him. He took all but one county, the county that Marco Rubio lives in. So he's got a lot of support in this state. It's just whether or not it's going to translate when you finally talk about who comes to the polls and votes.
So, but given that there's a possibility of Hillary Clinton eking out a victory, what explains a Trump defeat then?
I think it's all going to come down to Hispanic turnout. I think the numbers I've seen so far have just been extraordinary. It's been, you know, I think the expectation was that Donald Trump was going to wake some voters who hadn't been voting. And I think that maybe has happened, but the opposite has also happened on the Democratic side. People who haven't been voting are stepping up and trying to vote. And the turnout is showing that happening.
Well, Amy Hollifield, I thank you very much for joining us. We'll obviously keep watching the state, but at this point, you'd bet on Hillary Clinton?
Only slightly.
Only slightly. I know.
It's a toss up.
I know. It's a razor's edge, but
it could go either way. But I have a feeling it'll go her way.
Well, I thank you for joining us here.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Amy Hollifield, who's a government and politics editor of the St. Petersburg Times. She oversees state and national political coverage, including the paper's bureaus in Tallahassee and Washington, and at PolitiFact.com, the Times' fact-checking website, which received the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. She has more than a decade of experience working in newspapers in Florida, including at the Miami Herald and Florida Today. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His latest book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College drawing upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past four elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Hi, Ian.
And there you are, Robert, in the other key state that's a must-win for Donald Trump, Ohio. I take it it's not quite on the razor's edge as Florida is, and it looks like Trump's going to take Ohio. Is that right?
Well, virtually all of the polling that's been done, I mean, there was some back and forth there about 3 weeks ago where it was looking pretty good for the Hillary campaign. But in the recent couple of weeks, it's been hard to find too many polls that would suggest that she would win. So I think it would be a big surprise right now if Hillary Clinton were to take Ohio. And if she takes Ohio, then it's Katie bar the door for Donald Trump. It'd be over.
And what about the Electoral College, since you're a specialist on the Electoral College, one of the few people who actually have profiled and examined and effectively sort of collected the history of who these presidential electors are that go to the Electoral College, which is the next election after this one that takes place in about a month from now in December. Is there any possibility, given the narrow nature of this race, that it will go to the Electoral College? There's one candidate running for president, former CIA officer Evan McMullen, who's counting on it going to the Electoral College. That's his only path to the presidency.
Well, I think a lot of Americans are kind of getting a little bit of a civics lesson tonight in the fact that they're looking at state-by-state returns. And you can owe that to the Electoral College. And so we really have to be 51 individual elections. And, you know, Donald Trump, as we've been talking about, kind of has this narrow pathway to 270 Electoral College votes. If he were to perform as well as he possibly can and really sweep most of those battleground states, then we could be in for a real nail biter. It could be a very long evening. In some states, you're seeing, like in Ohio, for instance, he's outperforming with union households. That's the demographic he's gone after. And if they actually show up to vote in a number of these battleground states, then we could be in for a very long night, in spite of the fact that it looks good for Clinton in the last day or so of the campaign. And if that were the case, then that could potentially create some real unease in the Electoral College from the actual electors themselves. Evan McMullen, if he were to pull out a shocker in Utah, if we had a very close election and even one elector said that they were going to vote for Bernie Sanders, which we've already had that happen in the state of Washington, or an Evan McMullen for a disaffected Republican elector, oh my goodness, all kinds of crazy scenarios could emerge when the electors actually meet on December 19th.
So how likely is this? I mean, is there, it's very difficult predicting that we're right in the middle as results are coming in. You know, I'm trying to sort of follow the bouncing ball here as all these states come in. At this point, there's very little clarity. There is some indication, again, from exit polling that suggests that Hillary Clinton will sort of narrowly win, but that what is optimistic for the Democrats is the what looks like some pickups in the U.S. Senate. Already they picked up Illinois, but Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and it's very close also in North Carolina. They could pick up one there. So that seems to be the only sort of news so far, is that if Hillary Clinton is to pull it off, she's actually going to have a Senate that she can work with that's not going to block Supreme Court justices. So we won't have dysfunction not just in the legislative branch, but also in the judicial branch as well, which is what we have now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the idea of an electoral college shocker, you know, it's not probable. It is certainly possible. But if things do trend in Clinton's way tonight and she's able to win a relatively good-sized victory, it would be hard for Donald Trump to continue to claim of rigged elections and these kinds of things. If Democrats are indeed able to get a majority in the Senate, if they're able to get a good number of House seats, they're not going to overtake the House. But if they were to make some gains tonight, and you know, Hillary Clinton, she's a politician. This is one of the things that a lot of Democrats didn't really like about her during the primary season, is that she is indeed establishment. And she follows that game plan. So I would suspect that if she's able to win, she would probably, put the olive branch out to Republicans. Whether Republicans take it or not is a big issue. And, the kind of campaign that Trump has run in this general election season really is run a primary type of campaign, really going to the base. And, if he loses, and if he loses relatively big tonight, then Republicans, I think, are going to be scratching their heads and going, maybe we should take that olive branch. You know, the idea of saying we're going to sit with an 8-person Supreme Court, the idea of saying, you know, we're going to put impeachment, we're going to put Hillary Clinton under impeachment, those are the kinds of things that do not play well with most Americans, and would probably not benefit Republicans too much. It might help their base, but it doesn't help them win national elections.
Well, it does seem that there may well be two Republican parties emerging from this. If Donald Trump's undercover voters don't materialize, as they've been promised, then if, as you say, Hillary Clinton will offer the olive branch and reach out to the traditional Republicans. It's worth noting that Governor Kasich of Ohio is scheduled to speak at the American Enterprise Institute in the next couple of days. Apparently, he's going to make an important speech about the future of the Republican Party, and particularly his traditional wing of the Republican Party. So the question will be, where do the movement conservatives go, the Tea Party people? Does Trump act as continue his insurgency? And he's also got this possibility of a TV network. He's also, as the first guest we had on tonight indicated, that he's also got the potential to make a lot of money. and be a constant celebrity of sorts. If Sarah Palin can make a lot of money, he could certainly make a lot more in that regard. So if he forms this Trump TV with Roger Ailes and Stephen Bannon of Breitbart and becomes an alt-right version of Fox News, that's going to pretty much polarize and poison the political atmosphere. So it sounds like you're going to have two opposing forces here, an attempt from the Ryans and the Kasichs and the Republicans to sort of work with a new Democratic president. And then you've got this other insurgency continuing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you broke it down very well. And I think Republicans are really facing a crisis here if Donald Trump loses, because number one, he's not going away. As you say, whether it's a Trump TV or whether it's kind of a perpetual candidacy, he's not going away. And he's got a number of Americans that support much of what he's talked about. So, Tea Party, Freedom Caucus folks have found a champion there. And he's not going to just disappear. So, the Ryans and the Kasichs and the Rob Portmans and, these characters have had a very difficult time. Well, in fact, they haven't really embraced Donald Trump. And so, I had one of my students today asking me in class, will the Republican Party be able to survive after this election? And that's a reasonable question. What they'll look like might be pretty different. I think in 2008, for example, and in 2012, many Republicans felt like they kind of settled for John McCain. They settled for Mitt Romney, some candidates that probably had a much broader appeal than some of the primary candidates that ran against them. And, they had that thirst, that hunger to kind of get that bona fide, firebrand. Well, it's not like Donald Trump is a traditional conservative by lots of measures. In fact, that's one of the things that has bewildered a lot of Republicans, is they don't trust him as a real conservative. I think that kind of hunger and thirst to kind of be satisfied by throwing the red meat out there in this election, you've seen that with Donald Trump. I think if they lose and you've got a Hillary Clinton presidency for 4 years, I think that they're going to have a real thirst to kind of regress back to the mean and try and get anybody that can defeat Hillary Clinton in 2020. So, they're kind of working for that more moderate Republican. And as you said, John Kasich is absolutely angling to be that particular individual, and he's been doing so even during the primary season. And I think that there's going to be a real appetite for that among some Republicans. At the same time, you're never going to satisfy, that kind of lusting, Tea Party who wants to vote on the basis of principle, not necessarily to win.
Well, but how do you explain the fact that Rob Portman, the senator, who was one of the ones that the Democrats hoped to knock off in Ohio, has been reelected, and he beat the former Democratic governor, and he's repudiated Trump. He's wanted nothing to do with him, and yet Trump is going to carry the state.
Well, that's great irony right there, because in fact, Portman was a free trade guru for George W. Bush, and yet this is the exact thing that Donald Trump is arguing against. And you're right, like that makes absolutely no sense. A couple of things. I think one of the biggest issues right now is the fact that issues themselves are not really driving this election. It's really been a lot about personalities, and so if you were to put Trump voters and Hillary voters to the test to try and get them to tell you several areas of public policy and where their candidates stand on them, after several issues, they're going to fade away real quick. This has been a lot about personality rather than their politics. And I think that works to explain a little bit of that diversion or opposition that you have. Or that cognitive dissonance, I guess, between a voter who can vote for Trump and Portman in the same campaign.
So this is a very uncertain evening here, to put it mildly. Yeah. I'm trying to stay in touch with all the information coming in. None of it's particularly clear at this moment. The exit polls have suggested a Hillary Clinton victory, but it's yet to materialize. Trump's won all of the easy early ones in the southern mm-hmm. states, et cetera, the ones that he was expected to win. None of the big ones, key ones, have been declared yet. So what's your sense just where we stand in terms of if you have any clarity, because I certainly don't. I'm assuming that Hillary Clinton's going to win narrowly, and I'm assuming that the Senate's going to go to the Democrats, but that's just based upon information that could change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, Donald Trump has not been ahead in electoral and, poll state by state to give him 270 electoral college votes. Maybe since, and even then, I don't even know if he was actually ahead coming out of his convention. He was able to overtake Hillary Clinton as far as popular vote or popular opinion right out of his convention, but it was just for a couple of days here and there. And apart from that, he's been playing catch up this whole entire election season. And it's rare to find a candidate who is in that position, kind of trailing, and then, able to pass it or get it past the goal line at the last minute. That's very rare to happen. In many ways, much of what we would have anticipated tonight has actually materialized. Close races in Florida, close races in Ohio, they have been able to get a lot of their base out, and that has been pretty significant. You're right. A lot of the exit polling is suggesting that it looks good for Hillary Clinton, but that's cautious because it is exit polling. So I think, it could be a quick night in one regard if Ohio doesn't go Trump, which is unexpected. If North Carolina or Florida go for Clinton, then I think, we could be in for a pretty clear vision of what's happening tonight. But we may not know that for a bit.
Well, it's an amazing cliffhanger here. I've known so many people who've been so nervous about this whole situation. And there've been sleepless nights. There's high anxiety, particularly those that fear a Trump presidency.
I've been talking people down from the ledge. I feel like half political scientist, half psychiatrist. I've been talking people down from the ledge now for weeks.
And well, here we are, basically with no clarity. So one can only hope that in the next few hours, we get some clarity, I guess.
Well, I think most Americans really do want that. I mean, there's been so much talk, and we've never really seen that before about rigged elections and challenged elections and that kind of thing. I mean, that really is not the kind of thing that we typically see. It's been a very unconventional campaign with an unconventional candidate. And I think most Americans absolutely want closure tonight. They don't want to wake up tomorrow morning and not know. The idea of a Florida recount of 2000 is very unsettling to most Americans. The idea of a popular electoral college vote split, which is a possibility, again, is another thing that most Americans absolutely do not want to see. Most Americans, Republicans, Democrats, independents, apathetics, you name them, they want to know who our president is moving forward by the end of the evening.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Alexander.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I'll be speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History and Politics and Justice and professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His latest book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Nicole Hammer, the author of Messengers of the Right. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicole Hammer, who's a professor of presidential studies at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, where she works with the Presidential Recording Program. She is a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report, where she writes a weekly column about politics and history, and is a syndicated columnist for The Age in Melbourne, Australia. She's the author of Messengers of the Right, and also co-hosts and produces the history podcast Past Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Hammer.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Nicole, I know you've been busy tonight, and frankly, is there any clarity? My sense is that Hillary Clinton is probably going to squeak by. Democrats are going to pick up the Senate. They seem to be doing well in a number of states. But this is not entirely clear. So do you have any clarity?
Well, I don't think that there is a lot of clarity now. I mean, we can talk about sort of county by county. Is Florida going to tilt toward Clinton? I think there are still some votes out there to be counted for her. You know, Ohio seems to be a little more favorable to Clinton than we thought that it was going to be. But I don't think that we have much clarity now. And I think that that reflects overall the general tenor of the election.
So do you think, though, that reports that the Democrats will pick up these U.S. Senate seats in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Missouri? It's also very much a tie in North Carolina. They've already picked up Illinois with Tammy Duckworth. So what's your sense of that?
I think they're well positioned to at least get to 50. And that's all they really need to get to if Clinton wins the White House. So I think that they have better odds than not to get there. So that's looking good. I mean, how much they can actually do with the Senate once they get it, especially with Republicans keeping the House, it's hard to say. But better to have it than not if you're Hillary Clinton.
So in terms of your book, Messengers of the Right, did they all get the message in the sense that we've been told by the Trump campaign that there are lots of undercover voters that are going to show up that haven't been polled and that there's going to be a surprise tonight. What's your sense of whether that materialized?
Well, I think that if there is a hidden white vote for Trump, I think two things. One, we would see it in the upper Midwest. I mean, it's not just enough for him to win Ohio and Florida and call that his hidden white vote. I think we knew that those states were going to be close. It would have to be a surprise in a place like Michigan for that to really be the case. The other thing I would say about the hidden Trump person is that they're not necessarily primarily consumers of the conservative media that we think of, like Fox News and talk radio. But we would be talking about folks who read sites like Breitbart, this new populist right that isn't necessarily all that conservative. Movement conservatives, we know who they are. They're very politically active. If there is this hidden Trump vote, they're Breitbart voters, not Fox voters.
Well, but that's what's being sort of dangled out there as a possibility of a post-election career for Donald Trump, a alt-right version of Fox News with Roger Ailes and Breitbart's Stephen Bannon, who's running Trump's campaign.
Well, exactly. And there's a high possibility of that. Now, I don't think that Trump is going to invest a lot of his money and time into it. I think it's going to be like most Trump enterprises, somebody else is going to build it and do all the work and he's going to slap his name on it. But there is a real opening in the right-wing media market for a challenger to Fox News and to talk radio. And we've seen throughout this campaign forces sort of coming together. You have Ailes, you have Bannon, you have Sean Hannity, Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump. This is creating a new nexus on the right that's quite different from the conservative right that we've been talking about for the last 20 to 30 years.
But do you think, Nicole Hammer, that the fact that Trump has been talking for the longest time that this election's rigged and he's in effect delegitimizing the winner, which is at this point is likely or possibly will be Hillary Clinton, but not by much by the sound of it. My sense is that he's already laying down the groundwork to delegitimize her. And if you thought that Obama was shown disrespect, I imagine that a Trump alt-right network pouring out hate speech 24/7 will be designed, in effect, to cripple Hillary Clinton's presidency.
Well, if you think about how Donald Trump got his start for his political career, it was through birtherism, which was the mechanism for delegitimizing Barack Obama from the very beginning. And so it's not surprising that he will continue this project of delegitimating the next Democratic president in Hillary Clinton. We've already seen this even on not the alt-right, but in National Review calls for impeaching Hillary Clinton even before she's taken office. And that, too, that talking about her as a felon and a criminal and not qualified to run, shouldn't be able to run, as Trump says in many of his stump speeches, that's all the process of building up this this idea that she's not a legitimate president. And, you know, we saw it with Obama, and I think that should Clinton win, we'll see it with her as well.
Well, we'll see it on steroids by the sound of it. I mean, this is a quantum leap into a very dark place. So just in closing then, Nicole Hemmer, what are the next 4 years going to be like? We've been told, of course, in 2 years' time, the Senate could change if indeed the Democrats do pick up the Senate. But in general, if you're going to have Trump, Breitbart, Ailes, and Bannon attacking her 24/7, and if she's got a narrow win in the Senate, she won't have the House. Do you think it's going to be a functioning presidency if indeed Hillary Clinton wins?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I think that it's far more likely that we'll have impeachment hearings and we'll have Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And that is a sign that the government is functionally inoperative. The court has been crippled. The presidency has been crippled. The Congress has essentially been crippled because it doesn't govern anymore. And it takes two parties to fix that. Hillary Clinton and the Democrats can't fix it on their own. It requires a grown-up Republican Party to do that. And until they either grow up or they lose their majorities, then we're kind of stuck with a crippled government.
Well, Nicole Hemmer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor of presidential studies at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, where she works with the Presidential Recordings Program. She is a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report, where she writes a weekly column about politics and history, and is a syndicated columnist for The Age in Melbourne, Australia. And she's the author of Messengers of the Right, and also co-hosts and produces the history podcast Past Present. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was